Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Joining me for the 166th episode of Speaking of Mysteries is Sean Carswell, whose Dead Extra is scheduled for publication on May 14th, 2019. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and today we're talking to Sean Carswell, whose noir novel, Dead Extra, has just been published. Welcome, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
Dead Extra is firmly in the SoCal noir tradition. It's set in post-World War II Los Angeles and Ventura County. You live and work in SoCal, so I'm going out on a limb and suggest that's why you chose the location. But what made you What made you choose the time period?
Part of it was I just love novels from that time period. It's some of my favorite stuff to read. I also teach at a university, and most of my students are English majors, and they're mostly women of color. And a few years ago, I wanted to teach noir novels, but you can't really teach the 40s noir novels today because there's just kind of such a strain of really sexism and racism going through both of them. Women don't come off well, and to be a white man in front of a classroom of women of color and having a white man kind of bullying everyone and saying these racist and sexist things is not good. And so what I wanted to do was write a novel that had all the elements that I liked about noir from that time period. But hopefully not the elements that I don't love.
One of the main characters, Wilma Green Chesley, is dead at the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. One of the other main characters, her husband, Jack Chesley Jr., is presumed dead in World War II. And this struck me as mythic. The warrior, presumed dead, comes back to reclaim something. But is there anything to reclaim for Jack?
Well, there doesn't seem to be much, and I think that was one of the other aspects that I wanted to kind of update from the old noir. If you read, for instance, Raymond Chandler, I love his novels. I love Philip Marlowe, but he's a World War I vet, and he just doesn't have any scars. You know, he's angry and frustrated, but he doesn't seem to be dipping back into his past, and so. That just doesn't strike me as the way you come back from war. So I wanted to write someone who was coming back from that kind of really traumatic experience and was damaged from it. But is there anything for him to reclaim? I don't know.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point that these heroes in noir fiction that were written at the time, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, to a certain extent, Ross McDonald, although I think his characters carried scars, their tough guy persona doesn't let the reader in on that, whatever nightmares or gashes to their soul they might have. Mm-hmm. And we really see that Jack is damaged from so many things that he encountered in the war, not to mention being a prisoner of war, which was, I'm sure, extremely unpleasant.
I would think so, yeah.
Wilma has an identical twin, Gertie Green. And I have to give you props for doing this because identical twins in mysteries can be tricky, and if not handled right, can come off as contrived and a kind of a trope. I don't think that's the case in Dead Extra, but I'm wondering if you thought about that as you approached writing the novel.
I did. I thought about that quite a bit. I should probably say it's the character of Jack is loosely based on my Uncle Jack, who was a World War II veteran and He spent a couple of years in a POW camp in Germany, and he married one of a pair of twins. This is different from the book. My Uncle Jack actually married both twins. his first wife died while he was in the POW camp, and then he married her twin when he returned. And I don't think I'm giving away any spoilers to just tell people Jack doesn't marry Gertie. He doesn't marry his ex-wife's twin in this book. But I thought about that, and I thought a lot about Jack's, basically my Uncle Jack's relationship with his two wives, because they were very different. It never seemed like he was trying to replace one with the other. You know, it seemed like they were very different women. And my Aunt Frances, who was the second twin, the one who I knew, was very clear that she was a very different person than her sister. And so I think that's the case with a lot of twins. They differentiate among themselves. They share a lot, you know, and they're grouped together a lot, but they're frequently very different people. I think they're always very different people, not just frequently.
And we should say that in the book, Gertie and Wilma are very different people. Gertie is so no-nonsense, and Wilma is, you know, Wilma's passions can get the better of her, I think, is a fair way of summing her up without introducing any spoilers.
Yes, yes.
The dialogue and the narrative styling, to me, is in the noir tradition of Ross McDonald. And, of course, you sort of share a geographic thing with him, too, because, of course, he wrote about Santa Barbara. You have a lot of Ventura County in your book. But the approach, and you touched on this earlier, the approach to the subject matter, the powerlessness of women, the scorn with which interracial relationships were viewed, you filtered it through a 21st century sensibility. And how, you mentioned that you did this because you wanted in good conscience to be able to stand in front of a group in your classes of women and women of color. But could you talk about how you did this without setting off the anachronism alarm?
Well, yeah, I hope I didn't set off the anachronism alarm.
Not that I noticed. I didn't hear it.
Well, it's difficult. And I guess I should say, I wrote it a little bit with my students in mind, but I would never force my students to buy my book and teach my book. That seems a really, really kind of arrogant thing to do. I just want to write a book that they would enjoy if they should choose to pick it up. But as far as not setting off the anachronism alarm, I read a lot of stuff that was written by women in the 40s to write this book, because it's really tough to kind of cross genders when you're writing. And so I really tried to, and women in the 40s were dealing with these issues and writing about it and writing about it openly. And so if I could try to borrow a little bit of what I could glean from their perspectives, then it seemed like it could be situated in the 1940s. Because, of course, there were women who were frustrated with their powerlessness in the 1940s. That's not an anachronism. And there were people engaged in interracial relationships in the 1940s, and they were fighting against it. And so, well, we're more concerned with those things now, we're more openly concerned. They were concerned then, too. So I just, what I did was I really found the people who were writing about it then and tried to adopt their perspective as much as possible.
Right. I'm not trying to suggest that they weren't issues that received attention and consideration. It's
right,
just
right.
The more famous writers seemed to skirt about them. And, of course, the more famous writers were men. So that's one reason.
I didn't think you were implying that. The writers we are familiar with didn't care about this at all. And so to write, to write something that's very much in the tradition of Raymond Chandler or Ross McDonald and care about these things is a leap.
Your descriptions of the post-World War II film industry were delightful. And they were amusing, wryly amusing, not like ha 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 ha, but you had a lot of insight one of the things you did was you peel back the layers of who does what. And we discover, you know, oh my goodness, women are doing a lot of the work with very little to none of the credit or pay that, that, you know, they might entice a F. Scott Fitzgerald to come write, and F. Scott Fitzgerald might install himself in a booth at Musso and Frank's and mainline Martides, but somebody was doing his writing. And I thought in the book, you did a very good job of sort of how that was navigated by some of the women.
Thanks. And when I was doing that, there were some texts that I used to try to understand that. Part of it wasn't research. It was just a book I came across years ago that I read and loved. And William Faulkner was out in Hollywood, of course, and he had a mistress when he was here, and then he had a wife when he was back in Mississippi. And his mistress, her name was Meta Carpenter, and she wrote a book about her relationship with William Faulkner. And she never says it, but it seems that she maybe wrote a screenplay or two. And then also Faulkner is credited with writing The Big Sleep. And I've been looking into that quite a bit. And one of his co-authors is a woman named Lee Brackett. And apparently the story is Faulkner wrote half of the screenplay and Lee Brackett wrote the second half. And then Lee Brackett was brought on set, and then she would patch up the dialogue and rewrite any scenes. So it suggested that no one's coming right out and saying it, that Lee Brackett pretty much wrote The Big Sleep. She wrote her half, and then she rewrote Faulkner's half. And so I thought, you know, these are stories that are largely being forgotten, and if I can shine a little light on them, it'd be nice.
Well, Lee Bracken, I think, is one of the better-known women screenwriters. Yeah. She sort of followed in the footsteps of Frances Marion, who, you know, wrote so many movies. And back in the day when it was very much, you know, kids putting on a show, and anybody could be part of the motion picture industry. And then something happened, as things often do.
Yeah.
And women found themselves typing.
And I think, of course, we use different words to describe women doing the same job as men as a way of paying them less. So Faulkner would have been an author, and Meta Carpenter would have been a script girl, you know. And so so she would have been doing the same amount of work, and sometimes more work, but because she had a gendered title, you know, she kind of lost out on the money.
The film industry makes a great backdrop for noir, and I think one of the reasons that Southern California noir is successful, because you've got the fluid mixing of high and low that sort of extends beyond the gates of the studio, and, you know, it's like the Garden of Eden overrun with serpents, and it's not a setting that other noir set in other cities really can use. You know, they certainly can have high-low, they can use speakeasies and clubs, but those are sort of nighttime activities. The motion picture industry is an industry. It's a huge industry, and it offers this mixing during the day. So, I mean, were you conscious of that as you wrote the book? Like, this is just a great way for retrobates to meet, you know, otherwise decent, normal people.
I don't know that I was. I mean, I wish I could put it as eloquently as you just did, the Garden of Eden run over by serpents. You know, it's fascinating, old Hollywood. And I think a lot of us are fascinated with it, and but I don't know how much I thought about that, to be honest.
I think if you're originally from Southern California, and I've certainly lived most of my life here, it's something that you don't really think about. It's people, obsessive, crazy people like me who think about stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, I'm not from here, but I lived for a while in Los Angeles, and I obviously live near it. And but I've always been kind of away from the film industry. So I'm of course know people who are actors, and I know people who are writers. But when I lived in LA, I lived in Highland Park, and it was before Highland Park got gentrified, and so I didn't see any of it, to be honest.
Well, the idea of mental illness and what could be considered a mental illness is a big part mm-hmm. of this story of Dead Extra. Mm-hmm. And women especially could be sent away to Camarillo, which I'd love you to sort of describe, where until the early 70s was a massive state-run mental health hospital, and I'm using air quotes. She could be, you know, a woman could be sent by a male relative for basically being inconvenient. And that's something that mm-hmm. happens to Wilma. So, did you do a lot of research on Camarillo? Because it's been closed for a number of decades now.
Yeah, I should tell you what they did with the buildings of the old Camarillo State Mental Hospital is they converted them into a university. And that's where I teach. So while I'm talking to you right now, I'm actually sitting on the grounds of the old Camarillo State Mental Hospital.
Creepy.
And there's a ghost right over here looking over my shoulder, making sure I say all the right things. No, I haven't seen ghosts, but colleagues certainly say they do. But so the remnants of the mental hospital are all around me all the time when I come to work. And we have this tremendous archive. And I over the years have poked around the archive quite a bit and looked at the old photographs and read memoirs of people who were here. And it seemed that kind of common practice that, you know, instead of employing a full wait staff, instead of employing a full janitorial staff, a lot of the janitors here were women who were inconvenient. So you could have someone do a 2-month involuntary hold for alcoholism, for instance, and then basically what they would do is come up here and be a maid for 2 months. I read a memoir of one woman who did that. The memoir is called They Call Them Camisoles, and I named Wilma after the woman. The woman who wrote it is Wilma Wilson, and Wilma Green is not really based on Wilma Wilson, but I gave her the name. I read memoirs. I looked at photographs. I walked around the grounds. There are artifacts all over here in my day-to-day life. So, yeah, I really dove into the mental hospital.
Well, it does make a very good setting and to set some of the scenes that propel the story. And mm-hmm. so that's both interesting and, like I said, just a tiny bit creepy. I didn't realize. I knew that Cal State Channel Islands is in Camarillo. I didn't realize it was on the old hospital grounds, but
right.
You know, at least it didn't go to waste.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, at least the buildings didn't go to waste.
Yeah. No, it's a beautiful campus. It's a very restful place to get an education.
And get your brain tweaked, maybe. On a panel at a book festival, I once heard that noir mysteries are, at their core, about redemption. And your book takes place in the past, but many of the same issues still plague us, and the manner of corruption in high places may have altered a bit in its method, but it's still there. Women are still exploited. Mental illness continues to be an intractable problem. And powerful men are still calling the shots in the production industry, even with Me Too. So, having read your book and read the ending, I want to know if you think there's any hope for redemption.
There has to be, Nancy. Otherwise, how do we go on? There has to be. I mean, everything that every structure that we have in society, we created as people. And if we can create it, we can dismantle it. That doesn't mean you have to dismantle the whole society. And that doesn't mean I know how to do it. But I think characters like Jack and Gertie who have a solid moral compass and try to do the right thing instead of the easy thing. I think there's hope in that, because I think that's really how most of us are. Most people you meet are good people, and most of them are just trying to do the right thing. And I think that is kind of how we progress in society.
Is that what you would want people reading this book to take away from it? In addition to just, it's an extremely entertaining story. I mean, at times it's so cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs in the best possible way that, you know, I appreciated it. I appreciated the Southern California location because I live in Southern California. I appreciated the time period because, as old as I am, it's actually before I was born. But I'm just curious, when you sit down and you write a book, what would you like the reader to take away from it? Because writing is an incomplete art. It's not mm-hmm. done until the reader reads what you've done.
Right. I think this is the second time you've stumped me.
I'm so sorry.
More than anything, I want the reader to be entertained. I wrote the book to have fun, in a sense. I'll kind of tell a little story about why I started writing this particular book. Was I was doing research on an old crime writer, Chester Hines. And at one point in his life, he was broke, and he was living in Paris, and he needed money, and he went to a guy who had translated one of his early books to see if the guy could help him out, like maybe translate another book or something. The guy's name was Marcel Duhamel, and he was an editor at this point. He said, I can't translate a book for you, but I can publish a crime novel for you. And Chester Hines said, I don't know how to write a crime novel. And Duhamel said to him, it's easy. A man walks into a room. There's a dead body. He steps out of the room. He looks right. He looks left. Follow him. And so, I mean, Duhamel told Hines a little bit more, but I just thought, damn, that sounds so fun, you know? I'd love to do that. And one of the things Duhamel said is, don't worry about who did it. That's what the end is for. Just give me 220 type pages. So I thought, oh, I got to try that. You know, I mean, I know Marcel Duhamel's not going to publish it. I don't think he's around anymore. But just this idea of finding something and following it through. And so I wrote the book to have fun. And, I mean, I think the issues in the book are there. And I think they're there just because I'm a professor and I think about these things and I teach about these things. I don't know that there's a message.
Well, I didn't necessarily mean that there's a message, I guess.
Uh-huh.
I didn't. I don't want to get that deep,
I guess what I'm saying is I hope there's a point. I don't know what point you'll get out of it, though. I hope a lot of it has to do with what you bring into it and what you're looking for. And I hope what you're looking for is there. I guess is maybe the more accurate way of saying it.
Yeah, that makes me think of, you know, George Sanders uh-huh. says that fiction is the training wheels of empathy.
Uh-huh.
And I thought this made me think a lot more about women and how they were treated and how they could be carted away if they were mm-hmm. inconvenient and the price that they paid mm-hmm. for wanting to be different. And so that's kind of what I took away from it without it, while it was still wildly entertaining.
Uh-huh.
So that's
a great thing to take out of it. again, thanks. You know, I'm glad you put it in that way.
So this is not the first book you've written, but are you telling me this is the first mystery?
It's the first crime novel, yes. Yeah.
Wow, don't stop.
Well, thanks, thanks. I would love to write a sequel to this. What's that?
That was my next question. I would love to see Jack and Gertie again.
I would too. When I first sat down to write the novel, I didn't think of Gertie as being as big of a character as she became. But there's just something about her as I was writing her. She insisted on being in that book, you know. And then now I think, I got to keep writing stories about Jack and Gertie. Hopefully the book will be well received enough that my publisher wants a second.
Well, Sean, thank you for spending time with us and talking about Dead Extra and Gertie and Wilma and Jack. And hopefully there'll be another one and we can catch up again. And mm-hmm. I promise to do my best not to stump you.
I like it. I don't know if you'll keep this in or not, but as I told you, I like your podcast.
Oh, I'm keeping it in. I'm keeping it in.
Good. So one of the things I like is you don't ask the same questions every episode. And so I was coming in today. I was thinking, I have no idea what she's going to ask me. And I think that's what makes your podcast so enjoyable.
Bless you. Thank you.
And thanks for having me.